Conversations with Maria Menounos. Podcast edition. Inspiration.
Is there anything she can't handle? She looks fear in the face day after day, but yet she never runs. She's unbreakable. She's a warrior. She's you.
Growth.
But it ain't about how hard you hit. It's about how hard you can get hit and keep moving forward.
Community.
These things happen because you have to live your true self in a bigger way.
Featuring the best of Maria Menounos' SiriusXM show with celebrity and life-changing interviews, thoughts on the week, and more. And it's free. All we ask is that you rate, comment, and subscribe on iTunes and tell a friend to subscribe to SiriusXM. Listen to Conversations with Maria Menounos on SiriusXM Stars 109 at 1 p.m. East. And now here's your host, Maria Menounos.
Happy Friday, everybody. Happy, happy Friday. We're coming in with a little girl power. Every second, minute, hour, bigger, better. I don't even know the words, but I guessed them right when I did. This is Miss Megan Murphy's power song. I like this. I've got the power.
Right? Doesn't it make you want to work out, throw some punches?
We're both bouncing.
A little sidekick.
In the co-host seat with me today is executive editor of Good Housekeeping Magazine, Miss Megan Murphy. Thank you for joining me again. We had some good times this week. How do I not know this song?
Does it make you feel that? Doesn't it make you like want to like... go to a spin class or something?
Yeah. I like this. This would get me running.
Right?
Yeah, I would do like a good jog.
You could feel the football.
Exactly. Oh, this is a good spinning class, like,
yes,
song.
Because
you,
right? You
would spin, you know, you have to kind of rock side
to
side.
Like chilling.
So funny. Perfect for a Friday. We're ready for the weekend. Welcome back to the Conversations with Maria Menounos podcast, where we bring you a free, fresh source of news and insight. The best of our SiriusXM shows for the week. You can find us here every Friday on Apple Podcasts. Please be sure to like, rate, comment, subscribe. Tell a friend about the show. We're hoping you guys like the show enough to want to join us on SiriusXM every day. Weekdays on Channel 109 at 1 p.m. Eastern Time. You can also find us on demand on the SiriusXM app. But for now, we're here. And you're here.
Yeah.
And we're happy you're here. So Megan is rushing to catch a flight after this.
Yes.
And it made me think that I wanted to talk about in-flight etiquette with you.
Okay.
Because I feel like I always forget and I'm always frustrated on a plane. Or not always frustrated, but there are these moments of frustration. And I feel like this might be a good moment to figure it out, especially with you.
Yeah.
Because you're so Sunshine Committee, and I would like to get your take on all of this.
So etiquette how?
So when you're on a plane, do you have things that annoy you?
It's hard to annoy me, frankly.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, I just sort of like let whatever's going to be. I mean, I have certain – I like really work hard to get an aisle seat because I know I'm going to have to pee 25 times.
Uh-huh.
And when you have to pee 25 times, it stinks if you're the window seat and someone's getting up and down.
Yes.
And up and down and up and down.
Yeah. But I always pick the window seat anyway.
Because
I'm afraid someone's going to hit me in the head if I'm in the aisle
seat.
That's
a good call.
And
yeah.
It happens because they come in with all these bags and, like, and they're just reckless with them and they hit you and you're like, yeah, you just nailed me in the head. And they don't even apologize because they're mad.
I had on my flight here... somebody had a seat moved. They had some kind of an issue with their seatmate and actually got moved to middle row. And I was trying to find out what happened. I can't imagine something could get aggressive enough to be moved on a flight.
Well, didn't you hear the story? I think it was a few weeks ago. We talked about it on the show that a guy on a Southwest flight was masturbating next to this woman. Yeah. And then he masturbated into a napkin, gave it to the flight attendant. And she was horrified and traumatized, and they wouldn't move her.
I blocked that out.
Yeah, that was a big story.
Oh my God! Like,
I definitely think I would be freaking out. I would sit in the galley,
right? And maybe that person had like a sex addiction or something. Like, what would possess you to masturbate on an airplane?
People are disgusting.
Oh my goodness! That's now I want to get some like Clorox wipes for my flight to wipe down my seat before I sit down.
Oh yeah, I wipe things down. You don't wipe things down?
Oh, I do.
Yeah.
I'm like definitely have like germ worries.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, what about the windows. What is your window policy?
You mean up or down shade?
Up or down.
I like it up.
Oh, no,
I do. Well, I'm usually flying with kids, and I'm like, look, there's a mountain. Look, we're flying over there. Like, it's like educational. Yeah. Like, look. And it's sort of like a good distraction.
Yeah. Those clouds are known as cirrus.
Yeah.
These clouds are known as cumulus.
Are we there yet? No. Look, it's just clouds.
Yeah.
I do keep it open.
Here's the thing. I understand if it's early in the morning and you want to kind of look out the window or whatever, but most of the time it's not early morning and most people are exhausted and they want to sleep. I'm speaking about myself. Whenever I'm on a plane, I just find it to be my moment to just shut down and rest. And then you always have that one person that just has to keep their window open when the entire cabin has it closed.
Yeah, see, I think I would succumb to peer pressure in that situation and put my window down because I don't want to be that girl with the window up.
Yeah.
And frankly, like if at nighttime, yes, window down.
But at night, we don't need you to put your window down. We need to put it down during the day when the light's so bright. And I've got my iPad there and I'm trying to view things and your light is ruining my viewing.
And I'm super sensitive to people. So if I could feel like the glare on your iPad, I would totally turn it down.
Yeah. Can you feel my glare personally?
I would 100% feel your glare. But it's like when all the things are down, you sort of feel a little suffocated, like you're in this like flying sausage,
is that what it is? Well, it's good to know because I need to understand where they come from because Kevin really gets mad. Like I can just tune it out. I'll put a hoodie on and kind of do this and shift my, head or whatever. But when you see an entire cabin with the windows closed and yours is open,
you're not really being aware. Now, will you chit chat with a stranger? Like, how do you feel about conversation?
So if I'm not tired, I've definitely been a chatty Cathy on a plane for sure. I definitely talk to the flight attendants. I always have a lot of fun with them, especially if they're nice, which I've been getting so many amazing ones. Yeah. I just love talking to them.
I bring magazines. That's the trick. I just pass out good housekeepings to all the flight attendants, and then they're my friend.
Yeah. I think I'm open to chatting if I'm not tired. If I'm tired or I need to think, sometimes I use that time to really solve some problems and be proactive about things, and I don't want to talk.
It is good alone time. I find if I'm watching a movie on a plane, like the tears flow more easily. There's something about flying and crying it's like this waterworks for me sometimes. And then I'm like, oh my God, I wish I had sunglasses. Person could think I'm nuts. I'm starting to wipe boogers on my sleeve. Like, what's happening here? I'm a puddle. Yeah.
I was flying home just the other day from New York, and I watched that Clint Eastwood movie, 15 something to Paris, the terrorist attack on the train where those guys, stopped them. And I was hysterical, and I was holding on to my face and covering my mouth and just like this, because you're watching it and it feels so real because it's the real people. So you know that the way they designed each one of those scenes was exactly how it went down. The one guy, Spencer, when his friend, I think his name was Alec, said, Spencer, go, he charges this guy with this massive gun and it's pointed at him and he shoots, but a bullet didn't come out. But he's going right at him. Like, okay, shoot me, dude, but I'm still going to take you down.
And the craziest thing is you probably cried. I think there's like a physiological thing that happens to our bodies and our minds in air that makes us like even more emotional, more waterworks. I find it for me.
Yeah.
I mean, like
I watched March of the Penguins on a plane too and bawled.
And you're like bawling, right?
Yeah.
You're like, oh, penguins.
Yeah, so I think that I get that. I agree. What about where you sit, right? So who gets the armrest if you're in the middle seat?
Oh, that's true. See, I don't feel like I take up a lot of space. So I inevitably am sitting.
You are in the minority.
And I feel like I'm always near someone that's maybe double my size. So I'm always like, have the armrest.
Mm-hmm.
My biggest flying challenge is sneakers with socks or flip-flops. Like now I have flip-flops on. I'm like, I have like an extra pair of socks stashed in my bag.
Yeah.
The barefoot thing on the, like that's my gross out.
So I've had people who have taken their feet out of their flip-flops, put it on my armrest so their toes are hanging right by my elbow.
That's nasty.
I want to die.
But do you say anything in that moment, or like, what do you do? Do you get aggressive?
I just keep doing the turnaround, like kind of like, what is this? What are you doing? Without looking them in the eye, but the huff and puff kind of turn. And then if they don't get the picture, you kind of give a few elbows.
Like, okay,
like, get the picture, you nasty human. This is disgusting. It's like bad enough. At least if you are wearing sandals on a plane and you know you want to put your foot up, because we all do, I get it, it's an awkward position to be in for that long in this little capsule, put some socks on at least.
I hear you.
And don't encroach in my space. Put it up against the footrest on, or the armrest on your side. But you don't want your feet crawling up in someone else's space. That's disgusting.
I do feel like planes need a redesign, though. I mean, human beings are just bigger.
Yeah.
Like, that's just not a lot of space.
It's not
humane. It's, like, inhumane. And you'll see me. I mean, people probably think I'm freak of the week because, I'll start doing yoga. Like, I'll bend forward and do, like, you know, like arm openings just to sort of stretch, because I don't sit. I don't even have a seat at my office. Like, I stand all day long. So for me, sitting for 6 hours
it's torture.
Is like a form of torture. Like,
it is.
I go home and I hurt.
Yeah.
Like, my body feels gross.
Yeah. No, I understand that. I really do. I think they definitely need to redesign them. I can barely fit in the bathroom.
Oh, right. And like, we're not ginormous people. Like, that's
how does anyone fit in those bathrooms?
Let alone have sex. Like, that's what blows my Mile High Club. Yeah, take it.
Mile
you take
High
that
Club.
Mile High
Who
Club.
Who wants to have sex in a dirty, unclean, I know those are both the same, nasty airplane bathroom?
Especially, you can masturbate in your seat into a napkin and hand it to the stewardess,
exactly.
Right?
Like, clearly,
what?
That's
clearly
such a better way to go.
I think that's the problem. The bathroom was too small.
It's just disgusting. So my opinion on the poor person who got in the window seat, I mean the middle seat, my opinion is, because they can't lean either which way, they get both armrests.
I feel that. I like that.
Because the window person can lean into the window. Mm-hmm. The aisle person can kind of lean into the aisle when there's no cart coming through, for the most part. You have to shift a little.
You have a little more space.
But the window, the middle person has nothing.
Oh my God. I paid an extra $100 to be out of the middle on the way here because I was like, it's not possible.
Yeah.
It's just not possible.
It's definitely.
It's like a sandwich, a stranger sandwich. Here I am in the middle of these strangers.
Yeah. I think, and then the bathroom thing. So I do have a tip. If you have to sit next to the bathroom, and God forbid, a lot of people have had things their bodies haven't digested properly.
Oh, no.
Coffee grinds. So I ask the flight attendants for coffee grinds if I'm sitting near the bathroom, and they put them like above my seat or in my front pocket of my seat, whatever. And I just inhale that.
That's genius. Yeah. I like that tip, Maria.
Yeah, it's amazing. And by the way, it smells so good. I want to do it every flight regardless, but
that's a good idea.
Yeah.
I had a baby crawling up and down the aisle on my flight here, and all I kept thinking of was like the germs and the, like, I mean, planes are not clean.
No, and everyone's nasty feet.
Right? And
shoes.
This little baby was just like crawling up and down, and I wanted to be like, I work at Good Housekeeping. Please, please, this is unsanitary conditions. I'm a grime fighter.
But don't parents have to give in sometimes to their kids like being gross and on the ground of places?
And flying with kids sucks. I mean, it's just hard to keep them occupied. That's like, I'm like, okay, iPad, okay, chewing gum.
Is Benadryl lollipops inappropriate?
I gave
that, like, to my dogs once.
Yeah, no, we actually give a little Benadryl to my dog for car trips because he throws up. He threw up all over my winter coat, and I got to our destination on a road trip and I had no coat for the rest of the trip because my dog threw up all over me. So I was like, Benadryl's not such a bad idea.
Yeah. What about the kids, Megan?
No Benadryl for the
kids.
No
Benadryl? Okay.
It's like the one moment.
Wouldn't it
be
great?
Like,
then they're just lulled and they just don't.
I like their energy. I feed off of it. But I will give in to, like, you know,
a little wine for them. I'm kidding.
The Nintendo Switch. Well, my daughter had wine, a sip of wine at her communion. And it's still all anybody talks about. Charlie had wine. It was like, yes, it was her first communion.
Yeah.
She had a sip.
Yeah. She'll be fine.
She's going to be okay.
Are there any other things on a plane? That
snakes
that
on a plane,
nuts?
Just snakes.
Snakes on a plane
snakes
would
on
be
a plane.
Bad.
That movie.
Christy, do you have anything on a plane?
What about when they make you check your bag that you're trying to carry on? Like, I always get everything all organized so that in case the luggage that I've checked gets lost, I have anything on my carry-on that I need right away when I land. But then half the time you get there and there's no space to put your bag in the overhead bin. Yeah, and then they take it. And I think a lot of times you hear about lost luggage, it's in that case is when they have you check it at the gate.
Well, it's funny. When we were at the American terminal this past weekend flying home, the flight or the lady checking everybody in or at the gate was like, you're allowed two bags, one, you know, roller carry-on and one small bag. Meanwhile, I have one of those big-ass little sacks that, because my suitcase sometimes doesn't fit enough because I have multiple shoes I need to bring and whatever, I just stuff all the extra stuff in there. And it's just one of those huge bags, and I put it on top of my suitcase. I'm like, if they stop me right now, I'm going to cry. What am I going to do?
And what are you going to do?
What would I do? Now, I knew I was in first class, and I'm like, the odds of her coming for me right now are very small. But still, how are you, what's the judgment rule on a small bag? Is it a backpack? Kevin's backpack probably was just as big as my bag, but mine just stretches a smidge more, right?
I shipped my sneakers home this time. I had a whole prop box from some of the stuff I've been doing out in LA this week. And I'm like, I'm going to put my sneakers in there because I just don't think I have any more room to carry on anything.
Yeah, it's hard because especially when you're traveling somewhere, like we were going to New York last weekend and the weather was going to be all over the board. So you need sandals, you need sneakers, and then you need like your dress shoes for like dinner at night or whatever. Your shoes just take up half the suitcase.
That's the key.
Especially if you're a size 9.5.
So I packed gold wedges and sneakers. That was it. I'm like, if it can't work with a gold wedge, it can't happen.
Yeah. Yeah. It's traveling is tough. It's a lot of thinking.
I have to say one packing tip though, this worked so well for me this time. I had a lot of dresses and I rolled them up.
I roll everything.
And everything was perfect. Yeah. I didn't even need anything steamed.
Yeah. And also what's great about the rolling technique is you can see everything you have in your bag very easily and you never have to unpack. So I never unpack. I just have it all there and it's easily identified. The other thing I love is obviously TSA PreCheck is amazing, but those lines are just getting longer than the regular lines. I signed up for Clear and I love Clear.
So what's that?
So Clear, you sign up for at the airport. If you ever see a Clear booth, you go in, you sign up. It takes like 2 minutes. They take your fingerprints. They use your, you know, license or passport, whatever. And you never have to go through security. So that is your security. So you put your thumbprints or your two fingerprints on there. It visually identifies you either through the fingerprints or your eyeballs.
Okay.
And then they escort you right up to the security guy. You walk right past him and go right to the...
I wish I had that today.
Yeah. It's incredible.
That's genius.
Now, not every single airport has it yet, but they're all...
But like major airports.
Yeah, they're all...
What do you pay for that? Is it expensive?
I think it's like $100 or something.
My husband did something similar to that, but if both partners don't do it, it's a little tricky. Okay, see you later, hon. I got all three kids.
Exactly.
How's that going for you?
Exactly. Yeah. I think when you have the kid thing, it becomes a lot more expensive to do.
Right. You're like, okay.
Now you're up to like...
My 4-year-old's
$500
clear.
To get through Clear and... But I think for people who are busy and traveling who don't have a million other people to deal with, Clear is a really good one.
I like that.
Yeah. All right. Well, let's get to our amazing show, shall we? We have coming up next a psychotherapist that Megan helped me interview, a recovery coach. She's also an author of a book called The Marriage and Relationship Junkie, Kicking Your Habit. She's going to teach us how to kick the habit of being addicted to love. We also have an amazing interview I did with a woman named Kasia Urbaniak. She's the co-founder and CEO of The Academy, which is a school that teaches women the tools to expand their power. Megan, you're going to love this interview.
Cool.
She's a former dominatrix, and she teaches you how to navigate the most difficult conversations with verbal self-defense moves. It's unbelievable. Like, think of all the power dynamics that a dominatrix would use in the dungeon, which she talks about the dungeon. It was so cool. I wanted to ask her so many things about that, but I really wanted more tools than I needed to know about the dominatrix world. It was a fascinating interview. So she taught me so quickly how to come at somebody who has been nasty and put me in a really like rough position. Like if someone says, you know, Megan, do you think that you got to the level of success you got to because you're pretty? Like, what would you say?
Well, I'm not as pretty as you, Maria, but...
Oh, Megan, that's not the answer.
Okay, what's the answer?
Well, so she says, well, now I've placed all my attention on you. You need to throw it at me and say, do you know how unbelievably uncomfortable you've just made me? Or do you, does it feel good to know that you've just made me feel, you know, badly? Like, she gives you all of these tips on things you can say to switch the power dynamic.
I like that.
And it was really fascinating.
No whips required.
No whips required. And it's so fascinating. You're going to love
it. I like that. So it's putting it back on them instantly.
Yeah.
Do you know how incredibly awkward that made me feel?
Do you know how insulting what you just said was to me? I never would think to say something like that to anyone. And all I've definitely been insulted probably more than I've ever been complimented in my life. And people say awful things because they're insecure and they want to take you down a couple of pegs. And so to say something in a kind of like strong, powerful way back, like, do you understand the insulting quality of the question you just asked me? Holy shit. What's someone going to do when you say that?
I'm putting this into practice.
Right?
I love this.
And so you guys are going to love this interview. We're going to start with Sherry Gaba, our psychotherapist, and she's going to teach us how to kick the habit of being addicted to love. Enjoy.
My guest today is a psychotherapist, a life coach, and a certified recovery coach who helps people with addictions of all kinds. In her book, The Marriage and Relationship Junkie, Kicking Your Habit, she writes about why we become relationship addicts and how to recover. Please welcome Sherry Gaba.
Hey, thank you for having me.
Thanks for
being
here.
Totally cool to be here and so close to me.
I love that. So you talk a lot about addiction. I know we were talking about a complaint addiction earlier, but let's talk about relationship addiction. And are they all, are the foundations for all these addictions, whether it's relationship, drug, or alcohol, kind of the same?
So the hallmark of addiction would be if your life is out of control, unmanageable, like you're doing things that are just out of your character. If you're obsessive, you know, think of a heroin addict, he needs his fix. The love addict, the relationship addict needs the relationship to feel whole. You know, part of my story is love addiction. Started out with addiction in general, married an alcoholic, married multiple times. And my whole goal is to take the shame out of addiction, just like we're taking the shame out of drug addiction. It's a disease. And so I come from a lineage of love addicts, starting with my grandmother, my mother, and myself. And until I kind of got this, I finally wanted to just go out there and say, look, nothing to be ashamed of. We've had things happen in our lives, whether it's trauma, whether we have the genetic predisposition. Let's look at where it comes from. Let's kind of uncover it, discover it, and figure out how to change it. Because if I can just help one woman, man, not go out there and settle just because they can't be, quote, alone, or they feel empty, or they're trying to fill themselves up with somebody else, I've done my job. Of course. Yeah.
So you've studied at USC and I mean, you have a lot of different degrees, but what's interesting is I guess you never know what your therapist is dealing with in their personal life. You put it out there. You say, I am a victim of these different addictions, or maybe victim isn't the right word, but I struggled.
Yeah. I mean, I like being transparent. That's kind of my style. Yes, in therapy circles, you're not supposed to talk about yourself, et cetera, but if it's appropriate and it'll help somebody else, for instance, being married to an alcoholic, when I work with addicts, alcoholics, and I talk about my story, or I work with their spouses or their family members, there's a sensitivity that I have. And I think in recovery, whatever that recovery is, whatever, whether it's shopping, sex, love, codependency, worry, complaining, gossip, TV, internet, we have that ability to be able to share our story. And I think it helps people relate in a really profound way when they know, God, I'm not alone. Mm-hmm. And it can happen to a therapist. You know, we're just human. We're just people. Listen, I go to 12-step meetings in my community. I'm not ashamed. It's all about taking the shame out. That is my goal, to not judge the decisions we make, because there are things that have happened to us in our lives that have created these addictions. In my case, I tell the story every time, because if someone can hear it and it can help them, I was a preemie baby over 50 years ago. And in those days, they did not allow moms to touch their babies. You're a mom. I think someone's a mom here.
I got
Negative.
Three of them.
Three. Okay. Yep. So you remember that?
I had read that. I read that about you, and I do remember. So when I had my babies, they put them right on my body, and there's a connection and a closeness in that moment.
Attachment.
That I think is really healthy for the child. So when I was reading your story and you didn't have that moment, and you sort of said that that was part of the reason you feel like subsequently you've had
major issues, abandonment issues, separation anxiety. I couldn't put a word on it until probably about 10 years ago when I met an amazing therapist that does somatic work. And it was really about, I had my own intimacy issues. I keep picking unavailable people, but it was because I was unavailable and I was unavailable to myself. I was pretty much not present in my own body because, you know, think about being a little baby in an incubator for 3 months. You're being fed through your feet. There's no sucking response.
For 3 months?
3 months.
Because you were born, what, three? It was 3 or 3 pounds?
I was 3 pounds, yeah, 3 months early. Tiny, so, tiny. And then I had pretty much unavailable mother. I had a wonderful father. But unfortunately, she was also unavailable. And so this is a storm waiting to happen, right?
So can I ask you what a somatic work is?
So it's called somatic experiencing. It's Peter Levine's work. There's an amazing book called Waking the Tiger, and I recommend this to all my trauma survivors. And again, trauma can be earthquake, fire, tsunami, divorce, loss, death, etc. In my case, abandonment. It's basically getting back in your body, learning how to notice the energy that is in your body when you talk about certain issues or you're thinking about some trauma that's happened, noticing it, releasing it, noticing, releasing it, learning how to ground yourself in the moment. You know, that's what addicts are doing. They're getting out of the moment. They're running from themselves. They're self-medicating this, you know, our vessel. So it's learning how to be in our bodies and be comfortable in our skin.
So how do you do that now? Do you meditate? Do you exercise? Because you've been married and divorced 4 times. I think you're in a healthy place right now.
I am a really healthy place.
But so how do you do that somatic work?
So like I said, it's grounding. Like for instance, we could all do it right now.
Let's do it.
Move your feet and
I
listeners can do
floor.
It too.
Oh,
yeah. So you know what?
Put it in the air.
So do this. Like, you know, rub on your legs and just kind of notice, what does it feel like to just be here right now? Right?
We're all moving our feet around.
Move
Nick,
your
are you moving
feet.
Your feet around?
Yeah, rubbing my thighs.
Yeah, move your feet. And then notice your back against the chair, or if you're in bed, notice your sheets. Notice exactly where you are.
It's relaxing.
I know.
Like,
it feels good to, like,
I'm putting myself to sleep
your feet
right
around.
Now.
Isn't it amazing? Now, this is really, like, amazing. Look around the room. Like, what do you notice?
A lot.
What do you notice exactly where you are? And then maybe start to think about some trauma that has occurred in your life, some loss, some, you know, issue, something you might be anxious about. And then notice if you feel the energy in your body.
Yeah, I felt it right here in my
chest. Yeah, you could feel
instantly.
Like a wave of it.
Yeah. So what somatic work is feeling it and then grounding yourself, kind of pendulating back.
Like almost
forth.
Like they don't exist, or it doesn't exist because you're present here and that's just a thought.
You're actually releasing it, Maria, by just noticing it.
Okay.
Just an acknowledgement.
Acknowledging. I mean, animals, you know, have you ever noticed when you pet your dog, they shake it off after. They're done. Trauma's done. Not that that's really a trauma, but something has affected their body or whatever. Humans hold on to that trauma.
Yeah.
We have energy that we blocked.
Well, could I just shake? Because I'm really good at moving.
Oh, I love that.
shake it off like Taylor Swift.
Sure. I mean, that's one way. Yeah, but I think
it's
more
shimmying a lot.
Like, how about doing it in a present way? Noticing what it is that you're thinking about that's the loss or the trauma, and then noticing the energy. Yeah. Anytime you move is great.
Yeah.
But this is pretty particular somatic work. It's pretty specific.
I want to study that a little bit. I've
never
heard
of it.
It's a great
book,
Maria.
It's probably the best work I've ever done.
Really? How long did you have to do it for?
I think, and it's not a quick fix, and that's where we're probably going to lose everybody, because everybody, of course, wants a quick fix.
Yeah.
But I think around 2 years, well, no, that's not true. When I would say I started this in 2009, 2010, finally, I was able to leave my ex-husband. So I think I really started to get it after a couple of years.
So once a week you did somatic work?
I did, yes.
Okay.
I went to see it. And now I do it with my clients.
Was this after your father died? Because I know that was another traumatic experience that probably set you back a bit.
Oh, do I have a story. Well, what happened was I did finally leave the alcoholic because he kept relapsing. And that was my obsession. His disease was alcohol. Mine was him. Finally had the courage, woke up to my life, wanted to be, you know, go on, move on.
This is while you're a therapist coaching people
totally.
To do this.
I know. And it's
and
I'm
you
sure,
couldn't listen to yourself because you're a human.
I could actually, Maria, I could intellectualize it. I couldn't embody it.
Yeah.
I couldn't actually. Right. You know what I'm saying? The difference. Anyway, my dad died after 4 years after my divorce. And I took the alcoholic back. My dad had died. I was just devastated. I adored him. He was an amazing man and
father.
You
needed to cling to somebody.
And I did. I did. So I had a relapse, right? So when the alcoholic starts drinking again, we call that a relapse. I had a love addict relapse. And so I made a mistake, but I don't want people to call it a mistake. It's just a relapse.
Or a learning experience, right? Or a reset.
And some of us get it really late. I mean, I think you guys are quite a bit younger than me. I think that you're much more self-aware than probably my generation was. And so I think that you're probably making less mistakes or less lessons being learned. Or, no, not so much.
Just trying really hard. That's all.
You know. And then there's, of course, if we get into like talking about dating and dating apps and all these other things, that can create love addiction and stuff like that. But
I want to talk about all of that, actually. So define relationship addiction, and is it different than marriage addiction?
So I kind of coined the word marriage addiction because nobody's been talking about it. So relationship addiction is you do not feel whole unless you are in a relationship. You are empty inside. You have no boundaries. You will say yes when you mean no. You will, you know, you'll actually need another person in your life to feel validated, to feel acknowledged. Like when I wasn't in a relationship, I felt like empty, like there was like nothingness, like invisible. And just like the addict, you know, that needs that fix. I keep going back to that because I think it's easy to understand. Marriage addiction is really about that whole picket fence, falling in love with the illusion. I was more excited about the weddings than the marriage. Like, and I say this every time, if you looked good and smell good, I'll marry you.
Wow.
You know, it was like, not a
like
lot
Elizabeth
of
Taylor.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And I think we have some other celebrities that may be love addicts. I don't know if I can mention them.
You can
if
say whatever you think.
Was Zsa Zsa Gabor, right? Didn't she have like a bajillion marriages?
Well, I even think of like Jennifer Lopez.
Yeah.
Like she's been married multiple times, but she's had multiple relationships.
Yeah.
I think of Taylor Swift. You know, she keeps picking guys that are like from out of town that are unavailable. What's that about? Yeah. And then she kind of blames it on them and her songs. But really, what's going on inside of her?
But don't you think it's a little different with these celebrities? Because to me, one of the hardest things I can imagine is being in a relationship with another person that has an insane schedule that takes them completely out of the game.
Yeah, you probably would know more than I would. I would imagine.
Yeah, like you can't ever see each other. Yeah. Like you meet someone, you fall in lust, and then you're like, oh my God, yeah. I love you. You're amazing, whatever. And then, shit, I can never see you.
Or you don't right? really know them on a daily basis, and then suddenly you're actually living with them, and it's like who is this person?
Yeah.
Like you have that high of like long distance love, and then and that could be an addiction.
Well, it's like when you watch The Bachelor, and they create all these amazing trips and the most unbelievably
like
elevated dates, and so now of course whoever's in front of you, it could be a giraffe, I'd be madly in love
with you. They set
and
it
then,
all up.
Yeah, and then when you're back to you turn into pumpkins, and you're back into like civilian life, you're like, oh.
I think that could set somebody up for like romance addiction.
But I have a question because I like really love my husband. I married my brother's best friend, like, and I would feel lost without him. Does that mean I'm addicted to him? Because like I can't imagine.
I think that means you're in love. I can't imagine being without Kevin.
Right? Like I just wouldn't function without Pat.
No, I think that's interdependence, and I think that's really healthy. Did you make a conscious choice when even though you felt in love and you probably had
oh
all
no
of those...
I picked him
right you consciously picked
yeah
him.
I was like
not to
you
pick
are
him.
The one I'm gonna make you fall in love with me you have no idea I said this in my head I didn't say it out loud
but did you go through like why he might be good for you or was it just oh you
no,
know
he
like
was perfect instantly because I found out that he was a caretaker and I was like you're a caretaker Megan I laugh about this all the time I was like he had told me about how his dad had died a year before of cancer. And how he took massage therapy classes to heal him of his pain.
God,
and I was
Kevin.
Like,
I love him even more right
oh
now.
Oh my God, you're a caretaker? These are my inner conversations. I'm like, done. Done deal. Yeah. I don't know why at 19 I thought I needed a caretaker. But then you look at my life and you see everything that's happened. Yeah. And he's been above
that's
and
so
beyond.
That's so interesting, Maria, because... It's almost like you had an intuition that would be something that you might need. So that's something you can't even explain.
I did when I was younger. I knew something big was going to happen. I didn't know what it was. I always thought I was going to get shot in the back of my head or something stupid like that. Wow. I had visions of. But it was.
But you were kind of right.
It had something to do with my head.
That's so interesting.
That weird. I just realized that now.
That gave me like a little tingle.
Yeah. Yeah, that did that to me too. Did you have any early trauma of any sort?
Oh, yeah. Okay. Lots of traumas.
Okay. Okay. So without going into them,
yeah,
I think what happens is people that go through trauma are much more psychic, much more intuitive, because they always had to be kind of outside focused. Mm-hmm.
Well, and I didn't speak English first. Oh, okay. I spoke Greek. So Kevin's very convinced that because I had to use other sensory,
totally,
other modalities to kind of get through, because I had to learn English in school.
That makes sense. Yeah. Plus, so you came here from another country as well.
No, my parents were immigrants, but they didn't speak any English. So when I started learning English, I would go home and teach them.
Was there any bullying around that?
Oh, for sure.
Okay. Oh, yeah, that's tons, all trauma, Maria.
Tons.
Yeah. So you have it you have just this knowing, and you had it, and it occurred. And I always had it. I just never listened to it.
Yeah.
And I think that's the difference.
Yeah.
You know, because we really do have that inner voice. It's that God, you know, God, higher power, infinite intelligence voice. And if we just listen to it, you know, when I got married to my third husband, I was standing there and this big wall opened up and it was this big, you know, Jewish wedding and 300 people. And I tried to cancel it a few weeks before, but of course I was too caught up in the wedding. And all of a sudden the wall opens up and there's these big pedestals of flowers. And I'm about to go down the aisle and the pedestal of flowers falls on my dress.
Oh,
and it's like, hello, God, you're trying to tell me something.
Yeah.
So we have these messages. And that's what's so great about the somatic work, because you can't hear the messages unless you're present.
Yes. No, for sure. For sure. I believe that. I know it. I've seen it 100%. So because Megan and I are still trying to figure out what is the definition of a relationship addict, I know everybody else is probably wondering. So explain what a relationship addict or a marriage addict is.
So I like to look at my little handy notes because I want to make sure I get everything in and I don't forget anything. The over-adapting to what others want, not having boundaries, fear of letting go, being really afraid to let go. Fear of the unknown, like really afraid of what is going to happen, like wanting to control everything.
In the relationship?
Just life in general. Isn't
that like the definition of a woman? Aren't we all like, we need to control everything.
I think love addicts,
everything has to be perfect.
They want to control everything. They want to control everything that occurs.
Okay, that's me. There we go. And
also codependents are awfully, really controlling.
I'm totally codependent on Pat, though. Like, we're like a team.
Kevin and I don't function. Literally, like, if I could sew us together, we would be sewed together.
So again, I'm going to go back to interdependence. You guys are so blessed. I mean, let's go back to so much to be grateful for that you chose, and you also have this great team. You're healthy together. You're nurturing. You bring out the best in each other.
Mm-hmm.
It's codependent when you're actually getting sick, obsessing about someone who probably isn't very good for you. Like when I was with the alcoholic, wanting to fix him, wanting to change him, falling in love with potential, thinking it's going to be different. You guys aren't sitting here saying to me, well, I really love him, but, you know, I wish that like he would be more motivated, or I wish that he didn't drink so much. Or, I mean, you're not trying to change him.
No.
Yeah, I'm sure they're not perfect. Nobody is. Mm-hmm. But that's what codependency is.
Yeah.
And so it's not accepting what's in front of you and being in love with the illusion.
Okay.
Like being in love with who you think you want them to be.
Yeah.
Rather than who they really
How
are.
How daunting.
But that, you know, it starts with fantasy. I mean, I grew up and there was just, I had this fantasy kind of like dialogue going in my head. Like I'd make up soap operas in my head. And that was my like love addiction. I was like, you know, imagining romance and imagining meeting somebody. And it was just my escape. It was my go-to to kind of get away from what was around me. And so that's really how it starts. That's how the love addiction starts.
And did you have substance abuse issues on top of that, or love was strictly your addiction?
No, I'm pretty much codependent love addict. I would say that in my dating, there have been times where I probably overdrank. I'm not an alcoholic. I don't identify as one. But I'm sure there were times when I probably drank because I was a little anxious. And
You know. Was it the high school to college boyfriend that was the drug fog?
High school to college boyfriend. The fourth husband was an alcoholic. The first, I'm not sure what you mean by drug fog. I mean, I feel like
I was reading that your first boyfriend, you would go up to his your high school boyfriend, you'd go up to his room and it was like.
Oh, yes.
Yes.
Yes. Yes. So we did a lot of stuff. it was the 70s, guys.
Yeah.
But I wasn't a quote an addict.
It was just recreational,
whatever. Yeah. Okay. And that, and you know, sometimes it goes together, you know, sex, drugs, and rock and roll. That's pretty much
how
it works. Yeah. I forgot what I was saying. Oh, I was talking about what it is.
All the symptoms of being a relationship addict.
Yeah. Needing someone to feel whole, kind of needing someone to get rid of that emptiness. Needing others for validation, self-worth, affirmation. And of course, like I talked about my own story, fearing abandonment. And then really important withdrawal symptoms. You know, when the relationship ends, suddenly you're feeling like the addict feels when there's no heroin. You're just actually in panic. You're in terror.
Doesn't everybody, when they break up? Now, I've literally been with Kevin since I was 19, so I don't know. But doesn't everyone have that panic when they break up with somebody and that their life is over? I mean, I've helped friends through those moments, and that's how they feel.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. It's never, you know, breaking up is hard to do, as they say. I think there was a song called that, mm-hmm. right? But eventually you start, you know, getting out of that, and you start doing your life again, and you don't give up your friends, and you don't give up your hobbies, and you start living life again. Sure, breaking up is hard, but it's when it like takes on a pathological place. Like suddenly, you know, you just can't even survive because you don't have someone. I mean, for instance, my mother, who will not be hearing this podcast, my dad died and she was grieving. Sure, I get it. She ended up with a terrible choice. She did not really give herself enough time to get whole again, to really grieve the loss of my dad, who she probably would have never really gotten over, but she actually made a terrible choice. She's with a gigolo, someone, you know, 12 years younger, out with her for the wrong reasons. And I call that, you know, love addiction.
But she's still together.
And, you know, they're still together. He's awful. She constantly will say, I was so empty. I was so empty. I couldn't live without your father. So it's like it became pathological by making bad choices. Or like if you're somebody that is inviting someone from a dating app to your house on the first date, you know, that's not a good choice. So what's that about? That you're needing somebody so badly, you're inviting them over, putting yourself at risk.
Yeah.
Those are pathological.
Yeah. Coming in with a little Demi Lovato. Her song is trending right now. For all of these goodbyes. I think the song is called Sober, right, Nick?
Yeah, Sober.
I'm dying inside. She's talking about falling off the wagon. And the cold sweats disappear. Call me when it's over and myself is reappear. This song made me cry this morning. It's so beautiful and powerful.
I don't know why I do it every time. It's only when I'm lonely. Sometimes I just want to cave and I don't want to fight. I try. Just hold me.
Oh, when she starts apologizing to her parents, I lost it.
Well, especially the video when you see the words. I mean, that's powerful.
I'm not sober anymore.
Oh,
Daddy, please forgive me for the drinks spilled on the floor. To the ones who never left me, we've been down this road before. I'm so sorry. I'm not sober.
And it speaks to what we were talking about earlier back on the show with Sherry Gaba and, of course, Megan Murphy. If you want to get the book, it's called The Marriage and Relationship Junkie, Kicking Your Habit, available wherever books are sold. But you were saying people have relapses.
Right.
And she's having a relapse and she's being honest
about it. Like, you know, being married to an alcoholic and having the multiple relapses mm-hmm. that he had, it was trauma. I definitely got PTSD from that.
Yeah.
And when I heard that song, it just like, just kind of brings it up because it is so painful when you love somebody.
Yeah. And what does like a relapse look like by definition? Is that a sip of alcohol or is that a full blown problem? Like how, like what does it look like? Like what is it?
Oh, great question. Well, I think it's always a relapse when you actually go back to your drug of choice. But I think that's more like a slip and then you just go back to meetings. But you do have to change your time in terms of the 12 steps. But I think the most important thing is, do you get back on the horse? You know, some people don't. Some people go back out there, they die, they end up in an institution, they don't make it back. So it's mm-hmm. always dangerous to have a relapse. And even in my own life, like if I'm making such healthier choices now in my life, in my dating life. I don't think I have it in me anymore to be in the wrong relationship.
tired of it now.
I'm just done. I finally am just done. And yeah. So all the things I thought I was attracted to do not interest me anymore.
So if you go on a date with an asshole, you just walk out the door and like, oops, nope. My asshole radar is up. Not you.
Even beyond the date, like I was doing some of the apps, of course, and I can just see some things, you know, like the things that they say, you know, like, okay. Like one guy's like, oh, I think it's about time I now date Jewish women. Like, what does that mean?
Yeah.
Who were you dating before? You know, yeah. Like.
And what do you have against us that now you're now, okay with us?
Thank you, Maria. Thank right. you. So I really yeah. like am laser sharp in what I'm looking
for. Do you
for.
Have some red flags for listeners of a toxic relationship? Are there like three things to be like, mm-hmm. oh gosh, if any of those three things apply, like run right. fast.
Well, I'm thinking if they're a narcissist, that's a huge right. issue. Someone that's really more into themselves, has no empathy.
They're not going to be a good partner either.
Terrible partner. A lot of celebrities, narcissists, mm-hmm. marry narcissists, and then they become the narcissist team, you know, celebrity couples. But that's another issue. I think that's one. I think, and again, that goes to like always not really paying attention to your needs, not really listening to you, not being a good listener. I would say this, the three top things if you're entering into something that's really negative is someone that has abuse and doesn't have a program, you know, some kind of recovery program, infidelity, and, you know, physical or verbal abuse. All of those three things are super toxic. Mm-hmm. And they're just never going to get better.
So if someone is listening and they heard all of the relationship addiction symptoms and they're like, oh, that's me. How should someone approach figuring it out from there and getting help? And
yeah, well, the good news is they're on this show right now. So they're aware of it. They're aware of that there's an issue. So they're becoming conscious. There's great meetings, Sex and Love Addict Anonymous meetings. There's Codependent Anonymous meetings. There's really great therapists.
But what if you're like, ew, I don't want to do that. Like, that's not me. Like, I'm not going to go to that.
So, first of all, stop looking for outside things to make you feel good on the inside. It's really, you know, an inside job. Exploring your fears. Like, what is it that you're really afraid of? For me, it was like, I'm afraid to be alone. What is it? Are you afraid that you'll never get married? Are you afraid that no one's ever going to want you? Are you afraid you're not good enough? You know, getting out of denial. Addiction is the only disease that says we don't have a disease. So for the addict, oh, I don't have a disease. If he admits he has a disease and he can never use again. For the love addict, well, if I admit I have a disease, I can never find somebody again, or I can't ever be in a relationship again. So that's getting out of your denial, getting out of the idea that of being in love with love for love's sake, you know, getting out of the fantasy and just getting to reality. And again, this doesn't really sound sexy, but, you know, both of you, wouldn't you say it's the healthy relationships that you have that make it sexy?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I'm always mm-hmm. telling Kevin, like, how lucky we are.
And that you're great friends.
Yeah, and that makes me want to squish yeah. him harder.
Yeah, I think my husband's hot,
I don't know
too.
If that's sexy, but and I'm like, I love you, and, like, I wrap my whole body around.
Oh, hot is important.
Well, I think he's hot because he's a good dad, and he's a good partner, and he cooks, and that makes him hot. Like, all the things, he,
oh,
like, the
God.
Ways he loves me makes mm-hmm. him hotter.
Well said. So he's really thoughtful.
I got a good man. I got it right.
I
Thank
love
God.
You, yeah,
I got that, lucky in love, not in all other ways.
I think that's so great that you say that, because really what usually it's the fantasy, like when you watch movies, like, you know, and you look at like what is love or what is falling in love, it's all that other stupid stuff, like yeah. what they look like, and, you know, do they, you know, for me it was like, oh, if you were from New York and you had like that New York edge and you were like that bad boy and you needed to shave, it was the whole image, and it was
yeah.
and now I'm like, ew, like, no.
Yeah, you know? I always knew that the images that we saw on TV and on film were unrealistic, so whenever Kevin didn't fit those images, I never faulted him for it, because I was like,
that's not real anyway.
It's not real.
Yeah.
And so that, and I would see all my girlfriends wanting those things and then losing great guys because they didn't know how to do those things, because those are made up for the movies.
And or it's what they know. We always, sometimes we fall in love with what we know. Like if we had an unavailable parent, we're going to like unavailable. My yeah. dad was from Brooklyn, so I like that New York thing. It's like it's what we know. Yeah. I would tell them to look at their underlying trauma. Is there something that happened to them early on in life? I would do a lot of self-parenting, a lot of inner child work, you know, really loving that inner child inside of them. And most important, forgiving themselves, having compassion for themselves. And, you know, again, that's so important to me to get out there, is just stop beating yourself up. I did a lot of beating myself up. Yeah, I think
I think a lot of people are good at that. Sherry Gaba, guys, the book is called The Marriage and Relationship Junkie, Kicking Your Habit. You can get it wherever books are sold. You can find Sherry on Instagram at and Twitter at Sherry Gaba, G-A-B-A. Thank you so much for sharing
for
all of this great information. All right, guys, last but not least, my favorite interview maybe of all time, or at least one of them. Here's Kasia Urbaniak teaching us some verbal self-defense moves.
Hiya.
Guys, my guest today is the co-founder and CEO of The Academy, a school that teaches women the tools to expand their power and influence, a former dominatrix and healer. Today, she's teaching us how to navigate life's most difficult conversations with verbal self-defense. Please welcome Kasia Urbaniak. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
I love verbal self-defense. I can't wait for all the tools you're going to teach us today. But first of all, let's kind of go back to where your journey started. And I think, obviously, it led you into what you're in now, if I'm correct. I think some of the principles that probably were applicable to both worlds have helped you. Does that sound crazy?
No, it's actually totally accurate.
Okay.
And there's a huge distinction between what I teach now and what I used to do. But the understanding of power dynamics came from my past as a dominatrix.
That's what was screaming at me as I was kind of doing the research. I'm like, gosh, it makes so much sense. So how did you get into that world initially? And then how did you get out of it?
Well, honestly, I started working as a dominatrix in order to be able to pay for college, like many mm-hmm. women do. And also at the time, I was really fascinated with Taoism, like the Tao Te Ching. And
Can you explain Taoism for people who are listening?
Well, it's a Eastern religion, but it's less a religion and more a series of practices and philosophy. So, the Tao Te Ching, the I Ching. Actually, most Chinese martial arts and Chinese medicine come from Taoism.
Oh, wow.
So as I was working as a dominatrix, I used some of that money to go to college, and some of that money I used to travel around the world and study. And what I learned in Taoist monasteries about Chinese medicine, reading people's bodies, martial arts, being able to diagnose where the stagnant energy in somebody's body is by looking at them, ended up profoundly influencing how I worked as a dominatrix. Though at the time, I wasn't, especially in the beginning, I wasn't really aware of it. I started becoming a really excellent dominatrix. And it really showed. It really showed how, when I was in the room with a client, how I used my attention and ability to see people, things I was learning in the monasteries, to really have an impact on the person I was working with and move them through different states of consciousness and move them through different emotional states. And I became so good at it that the places I was working started asking me to train other dominatrixes. So I became a really successful dominatrix trainer. And once I started doing that, I started seeing a lot of common patterns. I mean, in the beginning, it didn't really become so clear to me until after a while, but really common patterns in where these women learning to do this would hesitate, or where they would be unwilling to do something that felt like an invasion of space of the client, even though they were getting paid
to invade their space.
Yeah, 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 yeah. It was remarkable. I also started seeing this thing where, I started when I was 19, so I spent all of my 20s with my dominatrix friends and non-dominatrix friends, and I'd see how my non-dominatrix friends, where their concerns were, what they were worried about, how they freak out over texts, how they wouldn't check, how they were afraid to enter the space of the man, especially.
They
would have a lot of superstitions and assumptions about like what a text would mean or a lack of a text would mean, or they would have a lot of assumptions that would lead to body shame. You know, like a really simple thing is like in a dungeon, being young and beautiful wasn't always a guarantee that you would get all the clients. Opposite, you know, like some of the women who are least conventionally beautiful, older, or overweight, would be killing it. And you'd be like, what is it that they're doing?
Yeah, what is it?
It's
how they carry themselves?
No, It's how they put their attention on the client. Their willingness to create intimacy through breaking all of the assumptions and the hesitation and entering that space. And not only that, but watching the impact of what they said and did on the man, and then calibrating and moving them accordingly. So the baby dominatrix would come in and she would perform power. She would be like, you've been a bad boy, but all her attention would be on herself and her performance. She wouldn't even see the places where the man would be showing shame or resistance. And the thing is, the places where the client would have shame or resistance, like, you could see it in the body. And if you could speak to that, there'd be a chance for them to be released from that shame. And that energy release is so erotic, so exciting, and so healing that I became really fascinated with that. And then every time I'd go and take another course or study at a monastery, have another period of time of learning some new tools, I'd go back and I'd see, like, this practice is a practice of power and attention, where it's possible to take another human being who's, it almost feels to me like it's almost inconsequential that it was in this context, but the dungeon became this blank space where free of, like, identity, free of truth, even factual truth, right? I could start playing with power and experimenting with this really primal form of communication, which is not related to language. I mean, you have to understand, I had a fake name. They had a fake name. The stories that would be made up would be totally made up. The role plays would be made up. And yet, this experience of intimacy, power, understanding, and opening and healing in an erotic context was profound.
Well, it elicited a response, whether it was fake or not, right?
Yeah, if you use fake in terms of whether it's factually true or not, then yes, fake or not. But what was true was the way that they were impacted by the kind of attention that they were getting and the kind of confrontation that they were getting with how they were being and the approval that came with it. And it sounds ironic, you know, dominatrix approves. But she does by eliciting it, witnessing it, and playing with it, engaging with it. So it was really unexpected because I went to the monastery to learn how to heal people. And I felt like I went there to learn how to heal and transform people. And the place where I found I could do my work the best was a dungeon where my job was to be like a hot bitch. Like it made no sense. But I started understanding that there's thing, like, submissive man or not, I started seeing in the world that people need this. People need this way of women being connected to a feeling and having the courage to really go there, to see somebody, to call it out, and to enjoy it and to play with it, to speak to it, and not assume all of these things about what a man is and his fragile ego and what he wants. Just blow those assumptions away and witness in real time, moment by moment, what the impact of a phrase is, what the impact of a way, and get curious about where they actually are. As opposed to, again, all these assumptions about how we have to be in order to be approved of, how we have to behave, right? Attention on self, right? And it speaks to a larger thing that I started to notice, where this is a generality, but it's powerful enough that it has an impact. Girls are raised to be rewarded with attention on them. What I mean is, when a little girl is growing up, there's a tendency to go, oh, look how pretty Mary is. Mm-hmm. Look how lovely her manner is. Look how lovely her dress is. Right? So we get that hit of approval when our attention is on ourselves.
Yeah.
A guy, a boy growing up, say Billy, getting older, the tendency isn't to go, look how lovely Billy is. Mm-hmm. The tendency is, look what Billy did.
Yes. Oh, my God. You're so right. He's so good at soccer.
Yes.
Oh, my God.
He is
such a genius at math. And we're just pretty.
Right. But here's the really important part. And this is the setup for my explanation of power dynamics. So if you repeatedly reward a boy at the moment his attention is out on something else, He understands that he gets belonging and approval in society for doing shit.
Yeah.
And for girls, as we're raised, if our signal of approval and belonging is every time our attention's on ourselves, we get the message that our way to succeed is by being something, not doing something. So our attention's on ourselves. So you hear it in elections, right? You remember a recent election mm-hmm. where people were saying, he's an ass, but he can get shit done.
Yep.
And she's such a bitch. Full stop. Yeah. Not that she can get shit done.
No. And worse, her suit's awful.
Yes.
Her makeup is terrible. Yes. Her hair, her this,
listen
her
to her
that.
Voice.
Good point. Yes.
Yeah. Okay, so here's the thing. In the animal kingdom and everywhere else, how do you recognize an alpha? In dog training, for example, how do you recognize the leader of the pack?
They show themselves to be the leader of the pack.
Their attention is on the whole pack. So to be in a dominant state of attention, your attention needs to be out. And to be in a submissive state of attention or a surrendered state of attention, your attention's in. You're feeling your feelings. You're going inward, right? So there's a default mechanism where women, especially in high-stakes situations, have a tendency to go inward. And there's a tendency for men in high-stakes situations to dominate and go outward. And this becomes super relevant when we start talking about sexual harassment or high-stakes negotiations or even erotic negotiation, right? Like this whole recent explosion and exposure of what women go through, mm-hmm. being sexually harassed or just being communicated to badly by awkward men, right?
Yeah.
What happens? What's the first thing that happens? Their attention goes in, mm-hmm. right?
Did I do wrong?
Yes. What do I do now?
What am I not doing right?
Did I wear something wrong? Did I give the wrong message, mm-hmm. right? So, guy.
Or I'm not enough at work or whatever it is. Yeah.
So guy puts his attention out, says something maybe inappropriate, confronting, and the woman puts her attention in and gets stuck there. And what happens when she gets stuck there is she goes into the freeze. Biologically, she freezes. She's stuck in an inward state. She's been taught the default state of inward attention. She's stuck there. The moment she gets stuck there, the moment she's in a freeze, she loses access to language and agency. Mm-hmm. So have you ever been in a situation where you've frozen and you're thinking about the thing you want to say, but you can't get it out? And it's like 1,000 thoughts
Absolutely.
A minute. Yeah.
So, I don't even think I cry. Yeah. I would just cry when this stuff would happen. And then later I'm like, why didn't I say this? Yeah. Or why didn't I do that?
That's
and
exactly
by the way,
it.
It's not me to do or say any of those things. Mm-hmm. And so then I'd be like, well, that's not me. So, and then I'd just be defeated.
Yeah. Yeah. And when the moment passes, the self-attack is incredible. It's like, why? In that moment where you're in the freeze, compliance is the easiest thing to do.
Yeah.
Right? Like, why didn't you leave the room?
Yeah.
Why didn't you fight back? Is always the thing that people ask women, victims of sexual abuse.
Yes.
Why didn't you stop him?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So she's frozen. Her biochemistry has changed. Her amygdala has been totally hijacked. She's been taught her whole life to be rewarded for inward attention, so that's going to be the default state. So in verbal self-defense, the first thing I teach is how does a woman go from that frozen state
mm-hmm.
into a dominant state of attention where she can regain access to language and agency, where she can break the freeze. How does she do that? So I experimented tirelessly in classes, and it ended up becoming so simple it's almost dumb.
No way.
The first thing she has to do is put her attention fully out on the man and ask him a question. Why a question? The moment a person's asked a question, even if it's for a moment,
they're on the defense.
They put their attention in.
Oh, so now you're forcing him to look within because he has to look for
the answer.
So
now his chemistry is changing just for a second. So he enters a submissive state of attention, or the attention just retreats enough so that she can feel herself again and change her chemistry, regain access to. So, a powerful question would be, do you realize that a statement like that might make a woman feel uncomfortable?
Oh,
right.
Good one.
That's a good one, right?
Yeah. But you even have if other you, ones that, good
but,
ones that
but
I've
even if
down
you
too,
ask
yeah.
a stupid one, where did you get that shirt? Even if you ask a dumb one. It's enough to give you access to language. You're 10 times more likely to walk out of the room. You're 10 times more likely to stand up for yourself because mm-hmm. it changes your chemistry. You are now, in terms of the primal language of animal hierarchies, of power dynamics, brain chemistry, you are now in the driver's seat, even for a second, even for a moment. It's enough to give you,
Yeah.
To catch up. And so this is one little simple tool, but it shows the architecture of power dynamics.
Yeah.
And the entire thing that I spent not knowing I was learning in the dungeon and facilitated by this intense study of Taoism and Taoist practices that involve knowing how to put your attention really deeply in, even feel your organs, and then put your attention deeply out and be able to see what's happening in the body and the consciousness of another. That is, you know, ultimate space invasion in some way, violation of privacy, like mm-hmm. really seeing somebody. And also, it's the greatest gift you can give a person. Because one of the tragedies right now that I feel, especially with men, is a lot of them are finding out that they've been doing things wrong and hurting women that they didn't know they were doing.
It's an interesting take.
It's not all of them, but there's a lot of men, you know, they should know better. Well, there's a lot of men who, like, they don't have the skills. They don't know. And you know what? They weren't getting real-time feedback.
Mm-hmm.
And you can't blame the woman. You can blame the fucking freeze.
When the whole Me Too thing happened, I felt a little guilty that I had played into some of this. When you giggle and you let them do things, right, mm-hmm. and you don't stand up for yourself, you're almost teaching them that that's okay, right? Not that, like, yeah, I'm going to take, like, a lot of guilt on.
No, but see, this is the thing.
But I know that there's an element of that because they've, and I've been saying the same kind of thing, too, is we've allowed them, and that has been the norm.
Yeah, and I really, really, really want to make this clear that, like, when you take a look at how power dynamics work and how women are raised, and you take a look at what happens biochemically to a woman when she's in that state, this is an exoneration. This is innocence. This is just an explanation of how things work.
Yeah.
Like, you exactly. giggle, you have, your state is internal, mm-hmm. you have too much energy, it comes out as a giggle, right?
Yeah.
Like, he's not getting the information he needs. Right. You're not getting what women call your voice and standing in your power. Mm-hmm. And I get really pissed when people say that. Find your voice, stand in your power. Give me an instruction manual.
Yeah, I need a friggin' tool, people.
Yeah. Yeah, it's not fair because then we're sitting there going like, oh, I'm so powerless and I sold myself out and the defeated feeling and the self-attack just continues. It makes things worse. So I'm really interested in people learning how to consciously enter these dominant and submissive states and see how, like, the argument a couple's been having for 20 years is actually a power dynamics issue. It's about where you put your attention.
Mm.
Or the fear of conflict or a high-stakes negotiation. What happens when a woman is confronted? So, you know, one of the greatest joys of my life is here I was studying all these things that looked really separate from each other, and they came together in this moment in time where, like, I get to do something to give women the voices they always had that they didn't know they had.
Yeah, that's amazing. You have a partner that's a male that started this business with you, which is kind of ironic.
Yeah.
Tell me a little bit about that.
So I met Ruben Flores, who worked for Doctors Without Borders, spent years in Africa in really high conflict zones and some really dangerous situations. And he was talking about how difficult it was sometimes to navigate, like, a border checkpoint where nobody speaks the same language and there's, like, you know, basically kids with guns on drugs. And he's like, we have to build a hospital here. You guys want to kill you guys, you know? And the moment we started talking, I started realizing that, like, he couldn't rely on language either or authority. There was just a piece of paper saying, I have permission. Nobody gave a damn.
Yeah.
And when we started talking, I realized that his understanding of power dynamics and mine were remarkably similar, especially when we're talking about power dynamics and primal mm-hmm. communication. And here he was on the fringes of war and death and, like, you know, that kind of horror. And there I was on the fringes of sexuality.
Mm-hmm.
And that we came away with the same kind of information. The moment we started talking, we basically couldn't stop. And we talked for 6 months. And by the end of that six-month conversation, we had a really well-articulated understanding of what we wanted to experiment with. And he started inviting people to our apartment so that we could experiment with them. We could experiment with conversations mm-hmm. and how these things worked. And the people who were invited ended up wanting to come back, which is how some of the first workshops started.
Yeah.
We didn't intend to start a school. It happened by itself. And like the first time we announced an actual class, we had an 8-month waiting list.
Wow. So let's talk a little bit before the break. You said, and by the way, for anyone who's wondering, there's so many things I want to talk about with Kasha, but we just don't have enough time. Dominatrixes do not have sex with their clients, just in case, because that was a burning question and I asked it during the break.
But you know what? I just want to add to that. You know, in a lot of ways, filling up an hour and creating an erotic scenario and not being able to have sexual contact with the client, not being able to have sex with them, is incredibly difficult.
Yeah.
I mean, you'd be, if you're in the weeds and you get stuck and you don't know what to say and you feel self-conscious and your attention's on yourself and you're not in the flow and you're not seeing them, a minute can last a lifetime.
Yeah.
It really demands a lot. And I think that challenge was something that really spurred on my imagination. And this is funny to admit, but like, I'm sort of an inherent people pleaser. So like, I really wanted to do a good job. It was really important to me to do a good job. How do I do a good job if the only tools I really have are how I'm being with this person, what I'm saying to them? And it was the best. It was the best challenge.
So before the break, you were talking about the arguments between couples are really just a power dynamic. Mm-hmm. And can you kind of just go into that a little more for anybody at listening?
Okay. So first,
who's got an issue at home where they're arguing with their husband.
So first, there's a couple parts to this. So first, I mentioned that there's a tendency for women to use the submissive state of attention, and there's a tendency, especially where there's pressure, for men to use the dominant state of attention. So women get together, tendency, like, please forgive the stereotypes. Generalizations can be helpful, they can be harmful. But two women get together to talk. She talks about her experience. Then, right? Mm-hmm. Submissive state of attention. She talks about her experience. Then the other one talks about her experience. Two men getting together, using the dominant state of attention, will get into a fight. So he can't talk about him. He can't talk about him, or they'll get into conflict. So what do they talk about? Something else.
Yeah.
Sports.
Yeah,
the weather,
they never talk about their feelings with their guys generally. I mean, when they
don't
guys
talk about
get
their
together,
own experience that way, right?
Yeah.
So in terms of dominant and submissive, what happens with couples very often is, if two couples both are tending towards a submissive state of attention, she'll talk about what's wrong for her. He'll talk about what's wrong for him. She'll talk about how she's suffering. He'll talk about how he can't handle it, right? Neither of them are seeing each other because both of them are in substates. If both take dominant states of attention, she's saying, you always do this. Mm-hmm. He's saying, you always do this. In order for some of these impossible conversations, these repeated arguments, to get fixed, one of the easiest things to do is to take turns. So she'll talk about her experience while he puts her attention on her.
In what way?
The easiest indicator, and this isn't a law, it's just a general tendency, is you watch when you use I statements and you statements. Maria, you have beautiful hair. You are looking at me intently. You are nodding right now. You are probably wondering what I'm going to say next. You are the host of a fantastic show, right? If I continue to do this, mm-hmm. you'll feel seen. I'll be dominating you.
Yeah.
Because the next thing I can say is like, wouldn't you love right now to hear what I'm going to say next? Wouldn't you, like, I can lead you through states. You feel mm-hmm. seen and you are exposed. Your tendency in response to that will to be to talk about your experience. I love having this show. Thank you for saying something nice. Da 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 da.
Yeah. No one ever says anything nice to me. And now I'm like in this state where you're like a god and I'm kind of like, oh.
I always say nice things to you.
I know.
Yeah, but you guys have a status differential.
Yeah.
I mean, you guys have a status differential, so it doesn't work the same way. Oh. You can't really top her successfully.
No.
Definitely
not. Well,
not to mention, even just from the kind of eye contact you have, it's obvious that you are dominant in a lot of your interactions, that you put your attention out. You might have a tendency to overgive, and you might have trouble asking for what you actually need from a vulnerable place. And that's from the way that you're looking at me, maybe mm-hmm. just because you're at work right now. But I see how strong and penetrating your eye contact is. You have no trouble invading my space at all. And it feels good because then I want to talk about myself. It's perfect. So
interesting.
So here's the switch. When a woman can do that with a man, when she can put her attention on him, you seem upset. Are you scared that you'll fail me? Does it upset you? Right? That because that's a reversal of the normal tendency, the first thing that's going to come up is resistance from the man.
What are you doing?
Yeah.
Right? And
because you're putting him in a vulnerable situation where he has to admit that he is scared or, you know, feeling inadequate or.
But if she can put her attention fully on him, not make it about her, put her attention fully on him and lead him through that process. And then this is the second most important thing I teach in the school. How to play with no, how to play with resistance, how to deal with when somebody's is either exploding or shutting down, right? Get curious about what's behind that, right? Really hold them. And not just holding space as in listen and let them run their mouths, but stay on top.
Even if you don't like them.
Well, it depends, right? I mean, we're talking about in a couple's relationship.
Yeah. But you said at work, that's why I was like, okay, let's switch to work. I didn't know if we were going into that.
Well, at work too, if you need to lead somebody, if you need to get your message to land, if you need your voice to get heard, it doesn't matter if you like them or not. You have to approve of them enough to be able to control them or to influence them. You can't reject somebody while having influence over them. It doesn't work. Why would their body and being trust you enough to even let anything in if you're not just basically approving of their existence? It doesn't work. We all have self-protective mechanisms that are older than the, you know, even the human species, and it's brilliant. So approval is a key element.
So switching it from you to them in the couple's dynamic is the key.
Yeah, I mean, there's other elements too. It's just like once you've had a fight for that long, repeat itself, there's a lot of hidden anger and a lot of hidden things that are not said. So for my students, I'd have them do exercises where they get to vent their rage and enjoy it, and they get to write down all the things that they're not saying, whether they're going to say them or not, and then write a long list of things they're not asking for.
Yeah.
Because a lot of the time, like, we go without, we withhold what we need and what we want.
Oh, for sure.
It's the death of love.
I talked about it with an author last week. I'm like, I muted myself so much just to be able to survive because I was too big for wherever I was. And you also hit the overgiving thing, and I know there are a lot of women who are susceptible to that out there. Talk a little bit about that.
So there's different kinds of overgiving. So in a dominant state of attention, when you have your attention out on somebody, you are providing something for them, right? You're giving them your attention energy. You're also giving them instruction. So you're leading. So there's a couple of things. One of the first things we do in the intro class that I teach about being powerful with men is teaching women how to ask. One of the first things that happens when I give them the first exercise is intense resistance. Like, there's the segment of the room that's going, I don't need anything. Totally independent woman, victorious, does not need a man, does not need anything from anyone. And in terms of, like, how times have changed, this is a really beautiful victory to have, you know? Like, it's... We've spent so many years with women being systemically dependent on men, on families, not being able to have jobs, money, property, right? So this is a huge victory. However, it's bullshit.
Well, it's also made us much more masculine, and we've kind of abandoned our feminine to become more masculine so that we can, you know, survive in this man's world.
Well, what ends up happening is... this independent woman ends up doing a lot of work that a man in her position wouldn't have to do. So she's doing everything. She's killing it. And the moment that she needs something, nobody can see it. Nobody can see her. The system's sort of set up so that when a man is doing his work, everything's arranged so he has all these invisible support systems. Mm-hmm. She takes great pride in not asking for anything. But if she does ask, she's creating a new support system for herself, which makes her actually more equal to a man in that sense. Mm-hmm. The hesitation to appear needy or desperate, the fear of that can be so strong that women end up working themselves to death. I mean, yeah. Really, and being lonely and pretending that they don't need what they actually need, what every human being needs, connection, intimacy, belonging.
Yeah.
One particular relationship pattern I see is women who are sort of in this independent state when they find a partner. We're talking about heterosexual relationships generally. So in this context, she will provide, give, nurture, do the what you call masculine giving and feminine giving, and to a man who ends up not having an opportunity to express his love through action. Mm-hmm. He ends up becoming smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller. And it's not that she's too big and too great. It's that he doesn't have the opportunity to also give. And it ends up becoming a vicious cycle, because mm-hmm. the more she gives, the more she provides in the masculine and feminine, the smaller he gets, the less capable he feels.
It pushes them into the feminine. Like Tony Robbins talks about the depolarization of relationships. So if we go super masculine, they end up going feminine, and then there's an imbalance.
Yeah. I mean, I have some issues with dividing it into masculine and feminine, which is why I also find this dominant and submissive polarity much more convenient, mm-hmm. because it gives women the opportunity to lead and still be women and feel like women.
Yeah.
Right. In whatever way they want, right? Whether they want to be what you call masculine in that sense or feminine in that sense, they can express power and influence.
Yeah.
And sort of dividing it from whether they're wearing a frilly dress or a suit.
Totally. Yeah. It's a very important distinction.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I think, you know, just how people say everybody has masculine and feminine sides, the nice thing about talking about dominant, submissive in this way is that it's just about the present moment and how you're using your attention. It takes how you want to express your gender, wherever you are on the spectrum, mm-hmm. out of the equation. And it gives, you know, when men want to, quote unquote, explore their feminine, what I see actually happening is they want to experience a surrendered, submissive state. And so when you take the word feminine out of it, they don't have to become new agey yoga dudes,
yep.
right?
Yep.
They can just go inward and get in touch with their feelings.
Smart.
And their experience, even in a masculine way, because you can be the surrendered, submissive state can be incredibly strong and powerful. It's how you know thyself. Right? You go inward and you're like, I know myself to be, I feel, I desire, I want this. This is where my needs aren't met. This is where they are. I have integrity. That's all a surrendered, submissive state of attention. It can be incredibly masculine looking or feminine looking.
Yeah.
It's about getting in touch with what's inside. And
I another, like that distinction.
Another thing that we forget, you know, this whole shift in gender is just like 5 minutes long when it comes to human history. For thousands of years, we've been asking men to stuff down their feelings, put their attention out, and go kill and die for us. That's not going to disappear overnight. Mm-hmm. So like the intense sense of betrayal, like fear that men are betraying their role, their society, the moment they go inward, is like a real thing. They're not supposed to be in touch with their inner state like this. It's not a fair ask to make. So when a woman can use her dominant state of attention to lead a man inward, she's giving him a gift that repairs millennia of asking Whoa. Them to die for us.
Kasha, we are out of time. How do people take your class?
Well, you go to the website, weteachpower.com.
Okay.
And we're also doing a really fun thing this summer for any good girls that want to break out of their good girl conditioning.
Yeah, me.
So it's like the Olympics. It's the bad girl summer games. And when you go to the site, you can sign up for that.
WeTeachPower.com.
That's right.
Okay, so if you guys want to find out more about her teachings, go to WeTeachPower.com. You can find her on Instagram at RealKashaUrbaniak. Man, being a Greek, I should be able to get this a little better. Twitter, it's at WeTeachPower. Kasia, thank you so much. And guys, have no question, we're going to have her back for more.
Hi-ya!
Kick that!
Yeah!
With my tongue! Take tongue lashing!
That was a tongue kick.
It's a tongue kick.
I love that. Megan, thank you so much for joining me today. This was so much fun.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you guys all for listening. I hope these interviews were helpful to you. You can find us here every Friday. That's our job. Every day we want to make you laugh. We want to have fun and we want to give you some good takeaways. So follow us at Maria Menounos, at SiriusXM Stars, at Miss Ashley Daniels, at Christy Reports, at Megan B. Murphy.
Woo woo.
And remember, people, be nice people, make good choices, and be present.